I'm pretty sure that like in Emily's, I don't know how many beers you had had, but you're like, you're part hamster. You're part hamster right now.
Synthetic hamster ovary.
Hi, I'm Ashley.
I'm Emily.
And this is Misconceptions, a podcast about two gals who understand the painful, emotional, sometimes absurd, and often lonely experiences of infertility.
Join us as we relive our own stories and welcome the many others willing to share their adventures. Okay, so this is episode 4 of Misconceptions, and I'm Emily, and I'm here with Ashley and our second guest ever, Mariana. And Mariana and I go way back. I think we've known each other for like 12 years, 11 years, and we're really excited to have Mariana on the show.
One thing that Ashley and I have started doing is we find ourselves repeating constantly, like the term or the phrase of like what your, have you had an experience, a journey? What's your path? What's your story? And we just constantly use these words like interchangeably. Yeah. So we've created a wheel.
Oh my God.
Of course. So, and so we're going to spin the wheel. Thank you. And then that's the word that you're going to use.
Okay.
And we're all going to try to use it. Okay. And once Ashley has her baby, we're going to turn this into a drinking game.
Okay. I love it.
Yeah. Okay. So here we go. Here's the word you're going to use today.
Okay.
Path. Your path.
Path. Ooh. Okay. I like that. Yeah. I can do that.
I think that the theme for today, if it's possible, is hope, because I think for you, Mariana, your story is like very front loaded with anxiety, and I can't wait for you to share what you went through. But then there's a lot of hope in your story too.
Yes. It'll be a really interesting juxtaposition because I did have so much anxiety, and as I went through your questions, I thought about my emotions during the journey. So it'll be that anxiety and how that manifested, and then yes, what it resulted in.
I think the floor is yours. So whenever you want to start your telling us your path to parenthood.
Path. Okay. Do you have a leading question you want me to start with?
Well, I think your situation is unique. Your path is unique. I think personally, a lot of people start by just not preventing pregnancy anymore. And then their path opens up however it opens. But for you, I think there was so much fear initially. So when did you and Anthony start talking about having kids, and what did that look like?
Okay. So, we started talking about having kids as the pandemic started to roll out. So, we had just sort of been at that crossroads of, you know, felt solid in our relationship, felt like things were aligning, and felt like it was time to try, despite also feeling like the world was turning upside down. But we didn't want to stop one thing for the other. We wanted to continue to try. But I think the story for me starts even before that, because I had in my head that it would be difficult to conceive probably since the time I started my period at 15 years old. It was so, my reproductive system has given me so many challenges for such a long time and has been outside the standard deviation of what my friends and women in my, you know, in my network have shared, that I felt I was going to be different. So I had, you know, from that early stage, nothing about my period was normal. It wasn't coming at a normal time. The flow was abnormal. The pain I experienced was abnormal, and that persisted. I got it late. You know, like I was just outside of every standard deviation that I felt like when I would talk to my friends and my family. And so I had sort of started to form an assumption, a belief that from the time of my period, being a preteen or a teen through 34 years old, that it was going to be very difficult to conceive. And lots of things played into that, from my abnormal sort of experience with my period through something that I'm sure we can touch on at some point in this conversation, my mom's experience and other women in my family and what they experienced. So Anthony and I started to try, take away contraception at the beginning of the pandemic, early 2020, but it came with a lot of intentionality and a lot of preparation for me, knowing and believing that it was going to be difficult.
So you weren't not prevent, or you weren't preventing. Nope. You weren't not preventing. You were trying immediately.
Yeah. Yeah. We had a conversation about, we had had many conversations in our marriage about when the right time for me to come off of birth control would be. And it just sort of, something about the pandemic, and you there were so many emotions around the pandemic about like what is happening in society and are we going to come out of this and what's that going to be like and what's the new normal going to be, that I think all of that was like, all right, there's a shakeup going on. Let's shake up our marriage and our relationship too. And let's finally do this. Let's try. So yeah, we just removed birth control from the equation and started trying and started tracking and started to, whether it's self-fulfilling prophecy or not, I want to talk about realism in this conversation. I was tracking and observing that, again, even after years and years and years, after starting my period, things are still abnormal.
Things like your cycle was abnormal.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yes, yes, yes. My cycle was still abnormal. So I have PCOS, and I didn't know that until I started trying to have a baby. And I've probably had PCOS since I was young, since I started my period, but I didn't know that until this path started. And I'm really grateful for that diagnosis because it helped some things all come together. But it was coming off of birth control after 20 years of being on it and hoping that maybe my cycle had changed, like really, really hoping that I'd come off of it and I would get a regular period and it would be normal flow and et cetera. And actually observed for about 2 years that I would get my period about 3 times a year.
That would be very hard to track, to keep track of ovulation, because who knows if that's happening. Yes. Right?
So many peeing on, so many days of peeing on sticks. Yeah. So many days of wondering if I read the thing wrong. So many days of wondering if that little, little spot on your panty liner was your period. Like so many days of wondering, that I think that bred some anxiety, because you're hyper attuned to something that isn't there, or what's happening in your body. But I definitely paid into several gimmicks. Not gimmicks. No, I will take that back. I paid into like the armband that you wear at night around your arm to track your cycle. And I tried to read that data every single day and create a pattern of what I was seeing. And there was no pattern. And it took me about 2 years to be like, there is no pattern. I need to go do something about this.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. And just, trying to track and then be intentional about timing things, and how we talk a lot about how unsexy that can feel.
Yes.
and just, sex as a chore when you're trying to, it's just like so unsexy, and
it is,
it's not fun.
It is. It's not fun. And I think this, Emily, about Anthony and I approach almost everything as all business all the time. And Anthony approaches everything from emotion. And so that made this experience, like we experienced this path from two very different places. Like I was like, business, it's, the time, let's go. And Anthony was like, I need the feelings.
I need the candles and the, the jazz music. I can relate to that.
The jazz music was a real thing. It was a real variable.
I agree. I thought that was just me, but.
No.
So would you share with Anthony, would you say like, okay, like it looks like my basal body temperature. Okay. And was he like, la, 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 just tell me what to do. Like,
no, he was into it. He was into like knowing the data too. And it was frustrating for both of us. And I think he gets frustrated more easily than I do. So on the upteenth day, the 77th day of no basal body temperature rise, like he was like, okay, like you're losing me, you know, but yeah, he was into the data, but he did not want to approach all of this as business. Like the emotions were much more forward for him.
Yeah. And it's so fascinating. So, you know, I think you said in your email to answer some questions that you're extremely private. Mm-hmm. And Ashley, this is the thing about Anthony and Mariana. You don't see them for like 3 or 4 months. And then when you do, they have like all these big updates and you're like, where have you been? And so I'm so curious. We talk a lot on Misconceptions about sharing and being vulnerable and how hard that is. And then also how isolating this experience can be. And then that occasionally it does help to share in the middle of what's going on, because then people can relate more than you even know. But you were not sharing this with people.
No. Even, you know, so two things. I think one piece that makes me open to sharing this story is how open you've been, Emily, about sharing yours. And I respected it and of course still do. And that made me feel like, one, I want to reciprocate, I can reciprocate, and maybe my conversation will spur something in someone else and they'll either reciprocate or, you know, it'll just open their eyes to some part of their path that they're, you know, needing to dig into a little bit more. But I just think you opened up and that allowed me to open up to you, but I don't necessarily do that with everyone. Yeah. And an example of that would be, you know, my family, the women in my family, my mom, my sister, my mother-in-law and my sister-in-laws were so invested in my path, you know, like how were we doing? And they knew we were trying and things like that. And they would want updates, of course, after every doctor's appointment. And I like my texts were like, same old, they're not quite sure why my cycle is so irregular. They're not quite sure what they're going to do about my PCOS. They're not quite sure. We're going to try some things. Thanks for thinking of me. Like, it just wasn't like a, hey, let me call you on the phone and tell you how I'm feeling and tell you what the doctor said and tell you what the path is. I just would just sort of send an update that said like, we're going to keep on keeping on. They're testing some things.
Yeah.
And that's been how I've approached this conversation. Like, I don't know that I've told the story to very many people.
Yeah.
Can you explain to us what PCOS is? Because I see here that 5 million women in the States of reproductive age are dealing with this. And that's, mm-hmm. that's, I mean, it says it's only like 6 to something%, but like, that's a lot of people,
yes,
dealing with it. So
I'm glad you asked, because it comes in many forms. So PCOS stands for polycystic ovarian syndrome, and I have some markers, but not all of the markers. And had I had all of the markers, I probably would have known as a teen what I had and may have been able to deal with it from that point forward. But I got the diagnosis when I was 33, 34 and trying to conceive. So that made sort of how I approached having PCOS very different. But PCOS is having, as it sounds like, cysts on your ovaries. You need a medical exam in order to see that. You need an ultrasound and you might need some dye to sort of see what you're looking at inside the body. It comes with sometimes it comes with external markers. So obesity could be a marker, unwanted facial hair and body hair could be a marker. And I don't have those things. So when I got the PCOS diagnosis, I was relieved in some way to have a name to why I have such infrequent periods, but also really surprised because I've known women with PCOS and I don't present the same way they present. And so that was interesting to sort of deal with. It was also interesting to Emily's earlier question of sort of the privacy that I had with family. Like, they were really interested in the PCOS diagnosis and hit me with a ton of questions like, but you're not obese. You haven't struggled with your weight. You don't have unwanted facial hair. So like, do you have PCOS? And I'm like, yes, you didn't see the inside of my body and the cysts on my ovaries. And, you know, so I'm not always comfortable with that question and that sort of questioning right after, you know, you send a text, but I dealt with it in my way. But yes, PCOS is having those cysts on your ovaries, and it often makes your ovaries abnormally sized and not quite right for growing follicles, releasing eggs, and that early, early, early part of conception that you need. Actually, it's not the early part of conception. It's part of your ovulation so that you can conceive. So my roadblock, so to speak, was early in that fertility path.
Okay, that was a very good explanation. That was fabulous.
Okay. Well, and I think our families and our loved ones, they just desperately don't want it to be true. Like whatever the diagnosis is, you know, they want to take that away from you. They want to say like that, you know, yes, it explains a lot of what's happening, but I think our families are so, that's not you. Like we want to protect you. We want to take care of you. Like that can't be true. We don't want to hear that something might prevent pregnancy. Like, you know, I think there's a lot of protection there.
I am really glad that, I don't know, that was very insightful. And you sounded just like my mom when you, when you sort of said, I want to take that pain away, or I want to take that scariness away of a diagnosis. So part of what I wanted to share in this conversation is that I still, in hindsight, feel I approached my fertility path and my infertility path with realism. I was into the data. I understood when it said that there was, you know, an 8% likelihood that some method that we used at the fertility clinic would work. I understood that 8%. And I really, I approached it with realism. So I didn't approach the early part of that conception path with hope. I was very realistic. Yeah. And I think that killed my mom and it killed probably some other, you know, supporters and allies in my world because they didn't quite know how to respond to my realism. I would say, okay, we're going to try this thing. There's an 8% likelihood that it results in conception. So I'm really level-headed about it probably not working. And that's okay, because we'll just try the next thing. And I kept saying, and that's okay, we'll just try the next thing. But the responses that I received from family and friends was like, 8%, like it could be, and like, you know, like hang on to that and meditate and hope. And I was like,
yeah.
Okay. And at one point my mom was like, you're cynical. I'm like, no, I'm not. I'm really realistic. And I really want you to respect the difference.
Yes. And I think, we talk so much about joy and, you know, hanging on to like this romantic feeling of like, we're just going to stop preventing and we're just going to have a bunch of fun sex and then we're going to get pregnant and have this beautiful baby. And you were science, you were math, yep. You were statistics, you were like, you removed the notion of this like whimsical pregnancy. You're like, nope, 8%.
Yep, 8%.
Have you taken the Enneagram?
I haven't taken the Enneagram. That's like the one I haven't taken, Emily.
Okay, I feel like I know what your number is.
I do. Wait, is the Enneagram, does that one touch on locus of control?
I only know it as like numbers on a wheel. Okay. And you're just like, you have different numbers, but your strongest number is like kind of your dominant personality. And it's really funny because Ashley, who I think of as like highly emotional, empathic, like sensitive, she's an 8, which is like a driver of like in control. I'm like completely, I need to know all my like options and plans. Yes. And
context.
And it blows my mind that Ashley's an 8, and I'll get over it. I think
I'm a closet 8. I think
that might need to be a second podcast or like a weaving in of a podcast.
Yeah, I think so.
I think I would bet quite a bit of money, Mariana, that you are also an 8. This sounds like it. 8 behavior. It's good. You need to take it. Okay.
We'll pause. Like, I think it's safe. Like, I think it's like a safe way to go about it because you don't feel foolish if something doesn't work. You're like, it's the practicality. You're not planning on plan B, but you know there is one, and you can sort of like think that way. Cause like we have one mosaic embryo left and I want to go into it in not the fairy tale way of like, this could be one of those surviving adorable babies and I'll tell them the great story that they beat the odds. But I also know it might not work. Mm-hmm. So
it is, there is safety in it. I think I appreciate that. And I appreciate the word foolishness too, because I think that was in a sense what you're trying to protect against. And yet at the same time, it wasn't, my realism wasn't driven by fear. Anthony and I were really open, really genuinely open to what the path would conclude as. We would have been disappointed had we not conceived. Yes, there would have been disappointment there, but we also knew that we were open to adoption and started reading about what that world looks like and adopting not for you, but because you want to support another human being and you're open, you're willing to open your home to that. We were trying to explore all options and really be open to all options. And I think my realism came from that, being hopeful that there was going to be some world out there, including being childless, that we were going to be completely okay with. That was really hard for my allies to understand.
Right.
They still really, really wanted the path to conclude in a baby, where we were really open to what the path would end up looking like.
I just think that's so emotionally mature. Like, I don't think I'm that mature to, I would probably lie on the floor and like pound going like, this is not what I want. I need to get what I want. Like, mm-hmm. I don't know.
That is something I just had my mom over for 3 weeks and we haven't lived together for 3 weeks in 15 to 18 years. I don't know. I haven't done the math on that, but a long time. And she was like, you're really laid back. You're really balanced. And I'm like, thank you. Because I was not that teenager. That was not who she knew growing up. And so I think for her to recognize that in me and see that I really was going to be okay with how the path ended up. And Anthony supported that too. And that was a life we were open to, whatever the possibilities were, I think took her by surprise.
Yeah.
I don't quite know how we got there, but I'm glad that
hope our mothers don't judge us on how we were as teenagers. It's like, I know. Some days I feel lucky mine's still talking to me. So,
yeah. Ditto.
Oh my gosh. Uh-huh. Too funny. Okay, so in an example of Anthony and Mariana not disclosing a lot of information, but then coming to a party and disclosing a ton of information, I think it was Asher and I we were celebrating our 10-year wedding anniversary, and Anthony and Mariana came to a bar to help us celebrate. And what did you tell us?
That day we had taken, Anthony had given me a trigger shot, our first trigger shot. And just the emotions around that, because I was nervous to have my non-medical field husband give me a shot. Like, that was what the day was about for me. It was like, are you going to hurt me? Like, do you know what you're doing? Did you read the instructions 8 times? Because you're about to stick me with a needle and I'm super nervous. But yeah, we got to the bar and we were like, okay, like we took the trigger shot and we timed intercourse and we're going to try again in like 4 days. And that was what we came to that party and just like, hey, this is what we've got going on. And Emily, you also shared a ton about your journey. Like, I had known about your path prior, but you shared some intimate details with your mom being present for you and just, you know, what that all looked like. And honestly, part of my realism was like, I took some of your story as signs and symptoms to watch out for. Like, I noted them down and was like, if you're experiencing these types of pains, like, this could be, don't wait, go get that checked out. That was an interesting moment because we don't share a ton of this journey with very many people, but Emily and Asher, we did have a lot of back and forth with. And like I said, your vulnerability and openness made you a safe person for me. So that we spent that evening talking about the trigger shot and what comes after and, you know, what it looks like when things go well and what it looks like when things are hard.
And I just remember talking about, I think we talked about how the trigger shot is like synthetic hamster ovaries.
Wow.
Yes, we did.
Now, is that real hamster ovaries or?
Am I still a vegetarian?
Synthetic.
Yeah, I had no idea.
I'm pretty sure that like in Emily's, I don't know how many years you had had, but you're like, you're part hamster. You're part hamster right now.
Synthetic hamster ovary. I had had plenty of beer and I, you know, I remember being scared of the trigger shot and you like grab the little like roll of fat in your stomach and you have this itty bitty needle. And I was like, oh my God. And then doing IVF later and the needle's like 3 inches thick and it goes in your butt cheek. And you're just like, I wish this was a little baby trigger shot with ovaries. Yeah. And I think the other thing too, Mariana, is that you guys finally decided that you wanted to talk to a fertility doctor. I think I just really appreciated that conversation where you're like, we're just going to incrementally grow this. Like, we're going to start with least invasive. We're going to try. Then that was the first thing you did, right?
That was the very first thing we did. That was true. You know, we had been taking, because I had PCOS, I have PCOS, the true first sort of intervention was trying to grow healthy follicles that would lead to ovulation. And, so for that, they had me on a breast cancer drug. And women typically are on that, women who are on their infertility journey trying to get pregnant take that drug for on average 4 days. Here's like my math again and just sort of my averages. I was on it multiple times for like 15 days without my follicles growing. And so I was on this like really harsh drug and, you know, going for every 48 hour ultrasounds only to find that the follicle, you know, didn't grow or grew and shrunk in those 48 hours and wasn't able to be used. So we started there and then we layered on the trigger shot because they felt like my follicles were growing enough to get me to a point where like, maybe the trigger shot, like it, you're like on the brink, you could try it. It may not work, but like it could work. And so we were like, sure, let's give it a go. So I was on that drug growing follicles, you know, watching them grow and shrink rapidly. Wow. And I will actually, this is a part of the story that Anthony and I reflect on a lot. We had an amazing ultrasound tech named Nancy. I will never forget her because she dug with that wand in me for so long, so long. It was like it had to have been a 40-minute appointment. She saw that everything on my right side, my right ovaries, that those were the ones that had been growing really well. She saw that they had shrunk down. Nothing there was going to be used. But she couldn't get a good image of all of my ovaries on my left. And she dug and dug and dug and would not give up until she felt like she had really imaged everything that she could see. At one point, she stopped and was like, I'm going to give myself 90 more seconds of looking. And then I'm going to call in another ultrasound tech. Like, they might just have a different way of looking. So she dug and dug and dug in those 90 seconds and like gave herself a little bit more time. And she found a like the largest of my follicles and it still wasn't mature enough for the trigger shot, but she's like, it's on the border and I'm going to send that to the doctor. She sent that to the doctor and that's what ended up getting us the okay to try the trigger shot with the understanding that it likely wouldn't work because it wasn't the right size, but go ahead and try. Let's just see. And that actually resulted in a pregnancy. So we always remember Nancy and her 40 minutes of digging, and like her, she was like mad. She was angry and like really getting in there, and she wasn't going to give up. And I'm really grateful for her, because there was exactly one that was the right size that, that wasn't the right size, but there was exactly one that was borderline enough to try. And that resulted in the pregnancy.
Because what you want is a really angry transvaginal ultrasound. That's what everybody.
She was like, I'm not giving up. I'm not giving up. I'm going to keep looking. And I was like, at one point I was like, you know, this is going to my realism on borderline cynicism. And I was like, hey, lady, there's probably none in there that are the right size. Just let it go. God.
Nancy, you're killing me, Nancy.
Oh my gosh. Where was Nancy for me? Everyone needs a Nancy.
Yes. Oh. Yes.
So is that Lupron that you were on that you took?
No, but I can't remember the name of the drug.
It's Trauma Brain.
Kind of remember it starting with an R.
Oh, okay. I don't know.
I will have to go back into my file.
This is going to happen at least once where I can't remember what anything is called. So
yes.
And don't go into your files on account of us, because that's,
What I don't quite understand what the cancer drug was for.
It suppressed a hormone that would allow my follicles to grow, because I wasn't producing that hormone on my own. And so they needed to sort of get some things, you know, they needed to create some difference in my hormones, because the PCOS was dominant and I wasn't producing follicle growing hormone. So the breast cancer treatment suppressed what needed to be suppressed so that the follicle stimulating hormone would grow and work. And that's, it worked a little bit on me.
How did you feel during all of that? Like hormonal balances?
I was waiting for like the mood swings, the hot flashes, to really not feel like myself. And I'm very, very fortunate that that just wasn't part of my path. They pumped me full of lots of things many different times. And I really felt like I stayed just myself throughout all of it. I really was cognizant that I was, you know, being fair, like at home, and that I wasn't like going off the deep end on anything. And that really just, I think maybe because I was so cognizant about it and I really was meditating at that time because I didn't want to let my emotions get the best of me. I knew that like being as stress-free as possible was only a good thing. So I was really, really cognizant of that part. And I felt okay during all of it. If anything, I felt like annoyed. Annoyed that the journey was going to have to continue. But ultimately balance that out with like, we're okay with any option and we just need to keep moving forward.
Yeah. I think my situation, I was more resentful than annoyed. I was a little heavier into the emotions, but I also took that like for the 4 days, or like every IVF patient I think probably takes it. And it's funny looking back, because did you not, Emily?
You know what? It was like a slew of medications. Like I probably did.
Exactly.
Yeah. So that's what I was going to say, because you don't know which one caused you to feel a certain way, because you're
true.
There's just, and they cycle and
yeah,
but your hormones were probably operating fine, Emily. Like you probably didn't need that boost to.
I have no idea. I do remember. And I think it was just like straight estrogen, which will wreak havoc on you, but I think I had like this blue estrogen medication that I had to like take vaginally. Yeah. And it was it's like foaming at the vagina. And it's like the least sexy thing you would like. I would forget. Yeah. And then I would go to the bathroom and I'd be like, I think I'm dying. Yep. What is this?
Oh my gosh.
My husband called me a Smurf because I was, you know, like had blue underwear every day. Yes.
Why does it have to be blue?
And why do you have to take it in your vagina? Like not that I would want to take it orally, but I don't know. I just feel like there could be like a patch we could put on or something.
Well, actually, hilariously about that drug, I remember I hadn't been on this path before. And so when I received that drug at the pharmacy, I read the instructions before I left the pharmacy and saw that it was taken vaginally. No one had told me that. So I'm glad I read the instructions because it is just a pill. So I could have easily taken it orally, but I read the instructions and then I got myself back in line and I was like, may I speak with a pharmacist? Because they typically ask you, do you want to speak with a pharmacist? They didn't. And he was like, I am the pharmacist. And I'm like, great. My question is, how do I see that I take this vaginally, but I don't see an applicator. Like, what do I do? And he was like, let me look. And he like goes to his computer and he was like, And I was like, do I use my finger and how far up do I go? And he was like, And then he said, I would YouTube it.
And oh my gosh.
So I left and YouTubed it because the male pharmacist did not know.
Oh,
he's like, God, I think I missed pharmacy school that day. I was like, this is not what I signed up for.
Oh. I was like, no applicator. So you have to have like this pill on your finger, but you have to like maneuver it gently and like not let it fall. Yeah.
You will drop a few in the toilet. Exactly. Or they'll roll on the floor and you're like, well, I don't know. That's probably fine. Something I found that I haven't even had the opportunity to share yet is that I remember someone giving me a hot tip on this lube that you could use and it helped people get pregnant or something like that. So I was kind of obsessed with that for a while. I'm like, this is going to do it. There's nothing wrong with our bodies. We'll just,
this lube is going to fix it.
Yeah. And so it came with an applicator. And I remember thinking like after dropping these little pills on the floor a million times, oh, I wonder if this would work. So I got, there was a unused one applicator and the little egg-like pill fit perfectly in the applicator, and it was still a horrible thing to have to do twice a day, but it worked so well. And it was like it just felt like a more reasonable approach to this thing.
I definitely think that we need to petition that company to send with an applicator.
Yeah, really. It's the least they can do. Like it's not a fun thing to have to do. And I remember my phone was set to 8 a.m. and 8 p.m. Oh my gosh. And my dad was on a drug at 8 o'clock at night at the same time, but he just got to take a pill orally.
You're like running to a private room.
Yeah. And we called them my pearls. And I was like, oh, gotta go pop the pearls. Or then we had all kinds of, it's so ridiculous. But,
absurd.
Yeah.
But I think that those are parts of the, like, I remember that that's a funny and fun uplifting story, right? Like you had names for the blue pills and we've all dropped them before.
Yeah.
But I do remember trying to be really mindful about having humor throughout the process. And that like, it was around the blue pill that Anthony and I had like a really funny moment, and just trying to stay balance that realism that I naturally have about work and personal life and everything with some humor and hope and, you know, what might be to come. That was, I tried to remain really intentional about that.
You have to laugh. You have to laugh at some of the absurdity and just like what you're asking of your body and what you're asking of your partner and just, you know, it's so vulnerable. Like you can be sexually intimate with someone, but until you're like, you know, talking about taking pills vaginally and then just like gross things are falling out of everywhere. And you're just like, wow, we've never been closer.
Yeah.
Yep, exactly. And that communication was so key. And even though Anthony and I have completely different communication styles, the fact that he was invested in my data tracking and I knew to give him the emotional support that he needed. I can't imagine, had he been totally uninterested in any of my data and I shrugged off the emotional part of this path for him, like that could have really, impacted us negatively. But that like give and take and meeting each other in the middle, yeah, priceless.
Okay, so back to drunk Emily and anniversary weekend. So Anthony and Mariana were like, we have to go because we have a lot to do this weekend.
So we did. We, you know, followed the very clear as mud instructions that the fertility clinic provided us, you know, and like made do with what they gave us and timed everything. And in fact, you know, all and I'm sure this is something that many of your guests will talk about on the show, but you take the instructions that the fertility clinic gives you, and then you spend like 4 hours online reading like other ways that you could approach it. And somewhere in the middle, it, you know, the fertility clinic had said time after the trigger shot at 12 hours, 36 hours, and 48 hours. And I think Anthony and I intended to sneak another one in there too, or something. I forget exactly how it went, but we missed one of the intercourse times. And it makes you feel, and it was just simply because like, we couldn't, like, we just like couldn't do it again. Like it was like that, it was too business at that point. And so we missed it, and it makes you feel like you threw your entire shot out the window, but we like tried again 12 hours later or like whatever it was, we missed our window by 12 hours, one of the windows. And so, you know, I think we both went through feelings of like, did we just mess it up? And like, we're going to have to do this again, or like, you know, whatever. We kind of had those feelings. But what's really interesting, and I'm jumping quite a ways in the story, is once we had found out that we did conceive, they're able to tell when your conception date was or is, and it ended up looking like our missed window for our, and then when we tried later is actually the time that it took. So it was this really cool, like in a path of things that don't work from preteen years to present, like the fact that you've kind of messed something up per the instructions, and that ended up being what helped you out, was a really, really cool kind of moment. And that kind of goes back to Nancy, the ultrasound tech too. Like, I didn't need her to look anymore. I was just like, it's not in there, let's move on. But she looked and she found it. So I'm in hindsight able to reflect on those moments where we thought we missed our window, Nancy kept looking, and like all of those things that align for you in the right way. And you know, just kind of cherish those things too, in a path full of things that often feel like they're not working. So we did end up just sort of waiting those 2 weeks. That's what you got to do after your trigger shot. And that was probably when I felt the most emotional. It just was like every little twinge was like, is this pregnancy? Because I had never gotten positive pregnancy test before. I had never gotten a positive ovulation test. Like I never had any line of pee work for me. So, you know, every little twinge was like, could this be? And that was probably the most emotional part of the path. We went hiking, we went, like, we did so many things to sort of take our mind off of everything for that 2 week waiting period. And I remember just so many physical symptoms that I had never felt before. Extreme fatigue, like couldn't finish an easy hike. Like was like begging to like crawl back, and it wasn't a difficult hike. I remember like my boobs killing, just like sensitive to the touch, and trying to temper my realism with like hopefulness. Cause I was like, wow, I've never had my boobs hurt that much before. I've never been able to not finish a hike before. I must be pregnant. Or like, you're exhausted and like, this is just part of what you feel. So those 2 weeks were probably my most emotional part of that, of the infertility path. And then I took that pregnancy test, and to this conversation about being private, I took it without telling Anthony. Like I woke up early on a Friday morning, went into the bathroom privately, peed on the stick privately, was utterly shocked that it was positive. Couldn't believe it. Looked at myself and it in the mirror, and then had to make the hard choice of do I tell Anthony, who's like 1 foot out the door for work? And like, what are we going to do? Like, bye. And like, he runs out the door and like, we don't see each other for a full, you know, 12 hours. I was like, that just doesn't feel right. I want to be able to cherish and, you know, like relish this. So I chose to keep it private for 12 hours. And
I do not know how you did that.
Yeah. I just like, and I think that was probably in hindsight, part of my own processing. Like, I could not believe it was pregnant. I took pictures of it and sent it to my doctor and was like, is this a positive pregnancy test? Like, clearly it was, but that's how unsure I was. Yeah. So yeah, I got that positive and sat on it for a full 12 hours. Anthony went to a happy hour after, and I was like watching my clock, like, when is he coming back? and he has since told Emily and Asher the story of when he did come back, I was sitting out on the backyard patio waiting for him, and he had taken the bus home because he had had one too many drinks. So like, his state of mind was already like, he was in a good place. And he didn't understand what I was telling him. Like, it took us like a few minutes of like, no, this is real. So that was sort of our cool moment of just, you know, being able to talk about that, couldn't believe it, and figure out sort of what comes next.
Yeah.
I love that. The 12 hours must have felt longer than the 2 week wait. Like, I just, ugh. I don't know. That takes some...
The happy hour, yeah. Was like the longest, it was the longest happy hour of my life. I was like, oh my God, come home. Yeah. And I think there starts a whole, you know, we've talked a lot about the infertility path, that realism, anxiety, cynicism, however you sort of want to peg it, that persisted every day through pregnancy. It was like, if my body couldn't conceive on its own, and if I'm not ovulating and I have PCOS, can I carry? And you know, is every little splotch of blood on my panty liner a sign of what's to come? Is the, you know, the way that I'm feeling emotionally and physically, especially through the early part of my first trimester, is that my body preparing for something to not work out? And so you know, you hear about miscarriages, like 25% of pregnancies end in miscarriage within that first 13 or 14 weeks. I was very cognizant that that's 1 in 4, right? Yeah. And like, there are no guarantees that I make it to the second trimester. And so that sort of realism came with me in pregnancy. And I don't know that I wish it would have, like, I don't know that I wish I were a more optimistic person. I'm okay with my realism. But it definitely, it made it so that I'm not sure I would do it again. I'm not sure that I would go through that path again of trying to conceive and then supporting the pregnancy and wondering every hour of every day if it would, you know, continue. So that's part of what I sort of carry with me.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I feel this, I can feel the same way about, like, if I still say if this all goes well, like,
yep,
like, what do we do next? Yeah, it's this, and like, oh God, are we gonna have to go through all that again? Like, I don't know if I can, like, hold it together another time. Like,
yes, totally. And it was, it's really interesting. Like, I was so cognizant of that 1 in 4, and here's Anthony like painting the nursery.
Yeah.
Like in the first trimester. And I was like, excuse me, have you read the statistics on like how this may not work out?
Yeah.
you know, but like, that was how he was so excited, and that statistic meant less to him than it did to me. And he wanted to paint the nursery and he did it. And I wanted to pay attention to the data and I did it. And so, we approached it very differently, but we both came out of that first trimester, and then we both came out of the pregnancy, really feeling quite confident that we wouldn't do it again. It was just a lot.
It is a lot. And yeah. We've talked a lot about how this whole path that people are on just is like, it just robs you of joy. and yep. optimism and believing that this is going to work out. What a hard, that's a lot to balance, a growing baby and fear.
Yeah, it was. I was much more fearful in the pregnancy than I ever was, of course, during the infertility path. And I would say I had an interesting experience at about 8 or 9 weeks pregnant. I went to a friend's wedding. I was so ill. I was standing up in the wedding. I was so ill. I did not feel good. And I had to let her know. She was the bride. And I had to say, like, I cannot get on the trolley with the rest of the bridal party because I will throw up on the rest of the bridal party. And she was like, absolutely. Like, take your, like, you know, my friend will drive you. So, cause I hadn't really disclosed that the pregnancy to very many people, but I had to disclose it to her because I felt like I was going to throw up on her wedding day. And so she called me 2 weeks later, maybe 3 weeks later, and was like, Mar, I'm pregnant. And I'm like, oh my God, why didn't you tell me at the wedding? Like, I was there. We don't live close. Like, I would have loved to like celebrate that with you. And she was like, because we got pregnant on our wedding night. And I was like, couldn't believe that was one of the only times that I felt that like, wow, I peed on sticks for like 2 years without ever seeing a positive. And like, you like, you know, tried night before and like it worked. And it was this mix of like total joy for her and her husband, because this is what they want and they deserve it. And they're wonderful people. And like, I cannot believe the path that Anthony and I have been on and how different it looks for different people. You know, it could be a hard pill to swallow.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I absolutely.
Or to shove up your crotch.
Or a hard blue pill to shove up your crotch with no applicator.
I also think, like, you know how sometimes you can drop like a cleaning thing in the back of your toilet and it like cleans when you flush. I think that when you're trying to get pregnant, you should be able to put a thing in the back of your toilet that like turns the water a certain color, like if you're pregnant. So if you like pee in the toilet, it turns the water like green or something.
We have had several ideas on this show. I will say an applicator needs to come with that drug. Something in the back of the toilet to color your,
And then if it,
those are great ideas.
I'm writing them down. So
if you're not pregnant, it doesn't turn a color. But if it,
It just stays.
I also think, you know, not to make this about COVID, but we could also be doing that. Like, it seems like we could do the same style thing for COVID.
Yeah. I love that Emily is going to be the back of the toilet, like drug tester.
Well, I don't want to swab my nose anymore. I'm tired of it. Just let me pee on something, because I'm pretty good at that. I've done that for years.
Yeah. Great aim.
And if all I have to do is sit down and pee and it turns purple, then I won't go anywhere because I know I have COVID. I just think we could do some things to make this process a little less clunky, because there's a lot of clunk, there's a lot of staining, there's a lot of just like really gross things.
Why has no one made blue underwear?
Right. For when you're shoving those. Yes.
When you're a Smurf.
Yeah. Okay, writing it down.
Or they send you, I'm telling you, they send you a 12 pack of those hospital underwear. I know, Mariana, you've had hospital underwear. What's your take?
I rather liked them. I liked the boy brief, like disposable.
Me too. I would wear it.
I stole as many as I could. And yes, and I wore them long past bleeding.
Okay, that's my Ashley's writing it down. I can see her writing it down. That's another marketing idea.
I write it down every time.
There will be an episode where I don't talk about those mesh underwear, those gauzy underwear, but I miss them.
Well, I had extra. I had extra.
It's a hot item. I want to interview like a labor and delivery nurse and tell her about this, and they'll say, we know you steal them. We give you extra.
That's correct.
I know.
Yep, they sure do.
They're like, we can't keep them on the shelves. They just fly off the shelves here.
Yeah. Don't take the heart rate monitor unless you really need right. it, but like help yourself to the
leave underwear. The blood pressure cuff, yeah, but please yeah. take the mesh underwear and the gigantic pad,
yeah, and the even blankets. I've heard people really like the hospital blankets. That seems like it's borderline how do you get out with all these blankets, but I'll try.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Ashley, that underwear is coming for you. You're just gonna put you're gonna no. think of us when you put those underwear on.
I might have to send you some.
Yeah. So it's not a surprise to anyone because we've talked about it and we can hear him.
Yeah.
But you have a baby.
Yes. That little 17 millimeter follicle that wasn't big enough to kind of make it into the green light of the trigger shot did take and resulted in, you know, a healthy pregnancy by and large, despite all of the facts and statistics that, you know, you're aware of. And yeah, I would say pushing him out was the easy part, getting over some of the anxieties of conceiving and carrying was the heavy part. And he is here and he is calm and cute and just has, of course, changed our lives in such an amazing way. And we still, my husband and I still look at each other and reflect on the journey and are on the same page, at least today, that we think that, you know, that he's it, that we don't really need to try again. And it should we get pregnant on my 3 periods a year moving forward? Like that'd be interesting, but that's not part of the plan. And we're really, fortunate that our path ended with Ellis, but we remained really open to what that could look like and what other options there might be. We feel like we, you know, we got really lucky, but we were open the whole time, open the whole time.
Yeah.
Well, for a realist bordering on cynicist, that is like mm-hmm. the most hopeful, like it is. It feels really it good was. To hear. And especially the part about like the pushing being the easy part.
That was the easy part.
That did not get lost on me right now.
that was like that physical, because that was really physical and it was the emotional burden of getting past, you know, 25 years of abnormal cycles and really believing that your body is different and knowing that your body is different. And then the anxiety of carrying and making sure that you and baby are healthy, like those to me were heavier burdens than the physical, you know, however many hours it takes to get them out. But yes, this path has taught me something about balance. I prioritize balance in my life, but, it really taught me to value who I am as a realist. And also, you know, allow some of my mom and Anthony's like romantic and hopeful feelings to sort of interject and keep you afloat in some of those hard times.
Well, I think Ellis sounds like he'll be a perfect balance of that too. That's like pretty cool.
he is already seems like a great balance of Anthony and I. That's he so really good. Does like physically and just his little personality at 7 weeks, you know, whatever you can make of it.
Yeah.
He is very upset right now though.
Yeah.
These aren't even his most upset cries.
Oh, okay. All right.
Those happen around 11 p.m. For no apparent reason.
Perfect.
I'll get over it.
Yeah. Yep.
All right. Well, dang, we so appreciate you being on and we're so excited for you having this adorable baby.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on. And thanks for allowing me to share the conversation with, you know, it helps. I don't know who will be listening. So I get to sort of keep my like curtain mm-hmm. of privacy, but also share a little bit about the path with other people.
Yeah.
Yeah. And just out of curiosity, as someone who is private, yeah. how did you feel sharing your path today?
I feel new. I feel like I haven't really thought about this story in a sequence. And I feel like there's even more, like I could probably continue to unpack emotions and details. But this is sort of a first, like first go at what the path was like for me. So I wonder how this story will sound as I continue to sort of share it with other people. I think that I'll get more comfortable sharing details. But this was a really, like, really special way to just start and share it with two people who understand.
Oh, makes me so happy.
That's awesome. And people will always want to hear about vagina pills.
They will.
It's the nitty gritty of it that is so relatable and hard to share, but then also that's where you find your connection, I think. Mariana, thank you so much. We appreciate you.
Emily and Ashley, thank you so much. You're professionals. I love it. I appreciate the opportunity.
Oh, thank you.
This has been another episode of Misconceptions Podcast. Thank you for listening. If you'd like to be on the show, please email us at misconceptionspod@gmail.com. You can also follow along for behind the scenes footage at our Instagram account, Misconceptions Podcast. Take care.